Part 2, Chapter 13, in which the reader will read, the listener will listen, and the writer will write what has been written. Quote, "Thy bosom is endeared with all hearts, which I by lacking have supposed dead. And there reigns love, and all love's loving parts, and all those friends which I thought buried. How many a holy and obsequious tear hath dear religious love stolen from mine eye, as interest of the dead, which now appear but things removed that hidden in thee lie. Thine is the heart where lost love doth live, filled with the light of my lovers gone, who all their parts of me to thee did give. That due of many now is thine alone. Their images I loved, I view in thee, and thou, all they, hast all the all of me." Shakespeare, Sonnet 31. "What was that?" said Mahogany. "That?" said Idothea with a smile. "That was your heart falling in love again." It was impossible to reach Valjalji by rail, so the group rode to nearby Siena. Idothea's grandparents were waiting when they arrived at noon and drove them to their home. The house was like many that bordered the roads through the fields of Tuscany. Three-story brick and plaster, several small windows, and a cement balcony over the front door. After they settled in and had lunch, Idothea and Mahogany went for a walk while Harvey played in the garden. It was a glorious afternoon as Mahogany and Idothea started down the tree-lined road to town. The sun suspended on the crest of a cloudless sky was beginning its descent. The air skipping across the fields was singing its song, and the insects and plants and animals, fertilizing, nourishing, and devouring, were busy about their dance. Through them all our lovers moved with an infinite lack of haste. The narrator breaks in. "No, no, 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 no. What is this headlong rush of unpunctuated prose? Is the end so near that the runner, straining for the finish, should break his stride and stumble to the tape? Is it possible that even the author of this tale does not understand that the journey is the end? Dear reader, ye of infinite patience and pardon, bear with me here and forgive this unreined, reckless run-on. I am weary and worn with the endless editing of this timeless and tormented tale. Help me to catch my breath, and I will close out this crude comedy with the same lack of grace that discolored it before." Back to the text. It was a glorious afternoon as Mahogany and Idothea started down the tree-lined road to town. The sun, suspended on the crest of a cloudless sky, was beginning its descent. The air, skipping across the fields, was singing its song, and the insects and plants and animals, fertilizing, nourishing, and devouring, were busy about their dance. Through them all, our lovers moved with an infinite lack of haste. Eventually, they reached town. There was one restaurant, one pharmacy, and the church where Idothea's grandparents had been married. "Vee Gates," said the first person they saw. "Vee Gates," said the second. "Vee Gates," said the third. "What's with the German?" asked Mahogany, turning to Idothea. "Oh," said Idothea, "a group moved in 15 years ago, and now they own the place." "What?" said Mahogany, suddenly losing interest in the town. "At least we have the walk home," said Idothea. Mahogany was still upset when they reached the house, so Idothea suggested they go into Siena. It was a 15-minute drive to a lookout in the western part of the city, and from there it was a short walk to the Enoteca Italiana in the basement of the Fortezza Medicea. Mahogany smiled when he stepped beneath the arched brick ceilings of the famous wine cellar. It was as if he had stepped into a mirror of Italy. Each region was displayed with a variety of bottles, placed on tables and ledges built into the walls. The first room was filled with wines from the north. There were the Pinot Neros and Gamays of Val d'Aosta, the Dolcettos and Malvasias of Piemonte, and the Berganzes and Bardolinos of Veneto. Then came the Schicchiatras of Cinque Terre, and as they passed the Parias of Tuscany and the Montefalcos of Umbria, Irothea began to speak Italian and imitate the accents of each region. She called attention to the various shapes of the bottles, listed which foods went with which wines, and translated the different descriptions on the labels. When they reached the Montepulcianos of Abruzzo and the Ischias of Campania, Mahogany coaxed her into a corner, and he kissed her beneath the watchful shadow of an Arborea di Sardegna. The next morning, Mahogany decided to stay on with Irothea and send Harvey alone to France. Harvey was glad to go, for he was anxious to see Sisyphus, and Mahogany talked to the ticket controller of the train to make sure Harvey would arrive all right. It was a dark and soundless afternoon when the captain descended from the train station in Carnoles. It had been 19 chapters since he had left the Riviera on his way to Paris for the Exposition Obsessionniste, and without Mahogany to guide him, he wandered aimlessly until he came upon the singularly dreary Hôtel de la Mer. With his first glimpse of the building, a sense of insufferable gloom pervaded his spirit, and as he gazed upon its bleak walls and vacant eye-like windows, he felt as if he were looking upon himself. A plank carried him across a black puddle that had drowned the yard, and deposited him at the entrance of the hotel. Once inside, he discovered there was no electricity. So he followed the walls with his hands until he came to a set of stairs which he descended until his foot scuffed on the floor. A small window near the ceiling illuminated a damp vault with an extraordinary collection of bottles. There was case upon case of cheap American beer, a handful of medium-priced French and Italian wines, a collection of Puerto Rican rums, a shelf of tequilas, and a single bottle of Canadian Club whiskey. It was as if he had stumbled into the cellar of his own soul and was standing before every drink he had ever consumed. "Everything I have left behind," he thought, "I have accumulated." Each drink had its own memory. There were lazy backyard afternoons, intimate winter evenings, people pushing parties, and all-night letters to a friend. He drank a Löwenbräu under a pine tree in his mind, then took a liter of Côte du Rhône wine and left the cellar. The first floor seemed bright after the darkness in the basement, and he moved through the hotel without the use of his hands. As he passed the rooms, he thought of the thousands and thousands of people who had rested there, the men and women of all professions, the good and the evil, the young and the old. Some had been born there, others had died there. And they had all left their emotions, filling the rooms with life until the rooms were empty again, like the emptiness in Harvey himself. The wood of the stairs creaked within him as the captain climbed to the second floor, and the third, and the fourth, and on the fifth he turned down the hall and opened an ancient door to a large and lofty room. A vague light penetrated the narrow windows, and Harvey struggled to discern the angles of the chamber. There were three beds. He tried the first one, but it was too hard. Then he tried the second, but it was too soft. Finally, he sat on the third, and it was just right. He set the wine on a writing table near the bed and left to find the bathroom. It was at the end of the hall, empty and abandoned except for a stained sink and toilet and a large tub beneath a curtainless window. After dispensing with his urge, he checked the water in the faucet and, finding it hot, drew a bath. It had only been 4 days since his visit to the Calendarium in Rome, so the warmth did not startle him, but it did inspire him to recline and watch the ripple of his heartbeat on the water. There was a reflection on the surface. It was another part of the hotel, visible through the window. Its vacant, eye-like windows lay across Harvey's chest, and it pulsed as if it were alive. Startled, Harvey sat up and broke the watery mirror. Night was falling, and Harvey had to grope for his clothes on the floor. When he found them, he walked to his room and dried himself with a sheet. Then he sat at the table. In the drawer he found a candle and matches and a pen and paper. He lit the candle, opened the wine, and began to write. Footnote. The page Harvey wrote was never found, but many critics have studied it nonetheless. The most remarkable essay is Stanislaw Poisson's There Is No Text. Back to the story. Soon it began to rain, and a wisp of wind made the candle flicker. Harvey rose to watch the clouds discharge their load, and when the storm had passed, he left the hotel and walked down to the water. In the darkness, he could see the surface swell and bend like an enormous black muscle, pushing its blood to the shore. It was the blood of his friend. O ageless wave, tireless Sisyphus of the sea, century upon century has seen your unending labor sharpening your tongue on the stones. Now, as this tale draws nigh, a dread beyond I know not what darkens me. I shall go forth, I shall traverse these seas a while, but I cannot tell whither or how long, perhaps some day or night, while I am sailing, my story will suddenly cease. O flesh, O bones, must we all then amount to but this? Must we barely arrive at this beginning of us? And yet, it is enough. O soul, we have positively appeared. That is enough.